Hello, everybody. My name is Dave Pistol. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very pleased to be here. I want to thank you very much for inviting Polly and I to come. I'm particularly pleased to be at a conference like this that's raising money to keep Central Office going. And so I think it's a double barrel pleasure just to get to come and share in something like this and to be here, because I have some idea of how hard it is to keep some of these operations funded and how badly some of these organizations need the money. And so I'm pleased to be here for that reason. So thank you very much for asking us to come and share in this. And it's also a pleasure to come to things like this, because you get to see, as Vicki was saying, you get to see people you don't get to see that often. And there's some people in this room that were together not too many months ago, because Vicki came down to Oklahoma and June was there, who's your Al-Anon speaker tomorrow, and she's a dynamite lady, and it's so good to see you again, June. And she's got her daughter Regina with her. And so it's very nice to see everybody again. It's nice to be here. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a long time ago, it seems like, but yet at the same time, it seems like it was only yesterday. And one of the things that we do very often in groups that I've been in is that we welcome newcomers. And so if you're new here tonight, or nearly new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't always ask people to stand who are new, but in my home group, we ask you to stand if you have 30 days or less of sobriety to identify yourself. We're real big on public humiliation, and actually, we're not. We just like to know who the newcomers are so we can get to know you, and, you know, we sort of home in on you. And what we're trying to do is attract you, because we have a tradition that says we're about attraction rather than promotion. And so if you're new or nearly new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, also in my home group, we have people that'll get up with 30 days and welcome the newcomers. So a newcomer is somebody that has at least 15 minutes less than you do. But we tell you a lot of things when you're new. We tell you that you need to get a sponsor and you need to read the book. And we tell you that you need to work the steps of this program and so forth. And we don't often tell you why we tell you those things. We tell you that you're very important to Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't often tell you why you're important to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll take a minute and just tell you a few of those things. You know, one of the reasons why we say you're very important to Alcoholics Anonymous is because you really are. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a little town in down in Texas that you may have heard of by the name of Dallas. And I walked into my first meeting at a place called Town North. And this was back in 1976. And I met some people. I remember very clearly meeting some people the first night I was there. I met a guy named Michael, who turned out to be my first sponsor, but Michael had 5 years. And I met another guy named Ray Kinney, and Ray at that time had 15 years. And I met a guy named Dick, and I met a guy named Bob. And Dick had a few days, and Bob had something like 2 weeks. And you know, the guy that I was attracted to was little Dick, because he just had a few days. See, I had no idea what to think about somebody that said they had 15 years. I mean, I had no idea what 15 years meant. You know, I just thought, I don't know what I thought really, but it seemed like I thought, how could somebody not drink for 15 years? I mean, it just seemed incredible to me. The guy I homed in on was little Dick. He had a few days. And I don't know, how the hell did you go for a few days without drinking? How'd you do that? I couldn't do that. I came to my first meeting drunk, and my second, and my third. How the hell could you go two or three days without drinking? So that's why we tell you you're important to us. People, you know, are going to want to know, how did you do that? How did you go 24 hours without drinking? The reason we ask you to read the book is because we think that our program lies between pages I and 164 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where the factual material is on this program. Alcoholics Anonymous is the basic text for our program, and that's where the truth is. And if you go to an AA meeting you go something like a step study meeting and you have 12 people there and you're talking about step 5, at the end of that meeting you're going to get 5 different opinions or 12 different opinions on how step 5 ought to be worked. Now nobody's going to intentionally mislead you, but you're still going to get a lot of opinion in that meeting. You won't get opinion in the book. So we want you to read the book so you'll know what it really says, so you know what the program is really all about. And we encourage you to get a sponsor because it's not easy finding your way around this place for a while. It took me a long, long time before I felt like I really understood what this program was all about. And then I found out after a long, long time, I really didn't know, because some more time went by and I found out, I didn't know after all. And then some more time went by and I felt, I didn't know after all. And I used to think that if I could just get 5 years, I'd sort of have it made. And then I got 5 years, and then I got 10, and then I thought that about 15, and I got 15, and now after 19, my opinion is I've made a fairly decent start. Now I've had a good beginning, and I'm grateful for that. But you need to know what goes on around here, and sometimes you just need somebody you can talk to and ask for a little direction from, because sometimes it's not real clear what the next step ought to be. So if you're new here, nearly new, we welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. We hope you read the book. We hope you get a sponsor. We hope you work these 12 steps over here. Is there anybody in here who the first time they walked in and read those 12 steps had the thought, that's the answer? That's it. Why didn't I think of that? Of course, there it is. I should have known that was the answer to my life's problems. So, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got here, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a terrible mess. I had never made a decision in my entire life that I thought would be harmful to me. Everything I always did for my benefit. What I thought would be my benefit. That would get me a little more money or a little better job or a little better house or something, that would be beneficial to me. And doing the very best I could for me, never making a decision that I thought would be harmful, I turned me into a derelict. When I reported for duty in Alcoholics Anonymous on April the 14th of 1976, I was at that time drinking about 2 quarts of vodka a day. I hadn't had a bath or brushed my teeth or combed my hair or any of that stuff for a long time. I really don't know how long. A few weeks to a few months, 3 or 4 months maybe. You can reach a point in the disease of alcoholism where things like that just don't matter anymore. It's not a big deal one way or the other, whether you bathe or not or brush your teeth. And I had reached that point. And I was unemployed, and I was unemployable, as you might have guessed. And I was just about one or two checks left from from running out of my $63 a week that I was getting from the Texas State Unemployment Commission. And I was married to a lady. At that time, the marriage was hanging by a thread. And the thread was a bottle of alcohol. It was a bottle of vodka, because she drank just like I did. Now, were it not for that, I would not have still been married. But I had, for all intents and purposes, maybe 15 or 20 minutes worth of life left on this planet. In fact, my first sponsor was a doctor. And he was the head of radiology at a big hospital in Dallas. And he said, the first time I saw you, I just almost didn't bother to come talk to you, because you just looked like you weren't going to live another 2 or 3 days. So I took it down to the wire. And I... I had no idea what was wrong with my life. You know, I didn't know. I didn't know why I was here. If I'd known where I was coming, I don't think I would have come. You know, you don't ever know for sure what you're going to do unless you have to do it. But I don't think I would have come to Alcoholics Anonymous if I'd known what I was going to find here. I didn't want to be seen by people like you. You know, I thought I'm going, you know, I had to, God, I wish I could be more clever for you, but I really thought that, you know, what I was going to find here was just exactly the stereotypical view that people have of alcoholics. I thought I was just going to find a bunch of old guys in army overcoats and rope belts and, you know, tennis shoes with no socks and no teeth and no shades and, you know, smell bad, look bad. And there wasn't one person at my first meeting that was like that, me, but I was the only one. And the first guy that stuck out his hand to me was that doctor that I mentioned. And see, he had come to that meeting in a suit. He had on a suit and tie. And he had his very pretty wife, Margaret, with him. And he'd ridden to that meeting in a very expensive car. And he lived out in North Dallas. And, you know, and I was not going to be seen by people like that. You must be kidding. This guy put his hand out and welcomed me. And there was a little lady named Helen Elliott. He came up and put her arms around me and she said, you know, we're really glad you're here and we hope you come back. You know, when people love you, when they care about you, you can tell. You know, when they're just talking, you can tell they're just talking. But when they really care about you, you can tell because you can feel it. And I knew that she cared. She really cared about me. And other alcoholics too, not just me, but she cared. And it had been a long, long time since anybody cared. But she came up and she welcomed me. And because of that, I went back the next night and the next night and the next night. And at least every day, at least once a day for the next 2 or 3 years. But the thing about it is that at my first meeting, I walked in not knowing where I was or anything, and I didn't know what was wrong with my life, and it was just a wreck. I was just a derelict. It was just, for all I could tell, it was just over. You know, this is it. And early in my sobriety, I got really caught up in finding out, whose fault is this? You know, how did this happen to me? And, you know, there's a guy named Terry who talks about this. He said, you know, if understanding whose fault it is, you know, understanding why you have the problem seems like it ought to help. It seems like that knowledge ought to help with the solution. It doesn't, but it seems like it ought to. And so I set about trying to repair what was left of my life. And the big thing I wanted to know was, whose fault is this? How did this happen to me? And if you're looking around for blame, it is easy to find. I mean, jeez. You know, there's a scapegoat around every corner. And there's a lot of people out there who are willing to help you, you know, get all the blame allocated and prorated and parceled out to all the right people. And so I began looking back over my life and I found, my God, you know, no wonder I drank so much. You know, look at my childhood. I recall my childhood, and I was raised on the streets, you know, really true. I was homeless before it became fashionable to be homeless. I lived on this little old dirt street, you know, in a little old place called La Plata. I had to go up when I was in the third grade and tell them that my home address was the Plaza Hotel, room 207. See, and everybody in this little town I lived in knew where the Plaza Hotel was and what kind of hotel the Plaza Hotel was. I played in alleys. You know, I played in the streets. I used to run around with this guy. He was about 25 years old. His name was Eddie. I thought it was John for a long time, but my memory's grown better, and I remember now it was Eddie. And he was a little guy that had a mustache, and he was very dapper, and he wore a hat, and not many people were wearing hats, you know, and looking dapper back in this time. This was a little small town down in South Texas by the name of Harlingen, and Eddie, I was in the third grade, and Eddie used to take me around with him, And what Eddie did for a living was he repaired jukeboxes and pinball machines and so forth, and we'd get in his truck, and we'd go to these beer joints and dives all over the place, and we'd deliver jukeboxes and pick up pinball machines and repair things. And, you know, and after every job was over, Eddie would sit and have a couple of beers with the owner, and that's what I did when I was in third grade, ran around with Eddie. And I was in the entertainment business. And I thought, boy, you know, somebody with that kind of a background, you know, no wonder I drank, you know, that kind of pain and so forth. And then I remembered on into my teen years and, you know, and growing up and, you know, and I had freckles and I had red hair and I didn't have any money. And, you know, so I couldn't date girls. I had no car, no money, no clothes. I had freckles and red hair. And what are you going to do? You know, I mean, girls are not going to go with you or anything. Of course, somebody pointed out to me after I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, well, did you ever ask any of them? Well, no. Of course not. They wouldn't go. I couldn't stand the pain of being turned down. And so I had that kind of trauma going on when I was in high school. These were not pleasant times, and I'm really not trying to make them sound like they were really funny, because they weren't. They were painful as hell. But, you know, but what I came away with, trying to figure out why I was an alcoholic and what had happened in my life to make me that way, and why I so desperately wanted it not to be my fault that I was in this mess, was that I just got into that typical victim mentality. You know, this is not my fault. You can't blame me. I didn't do this. And I found out after being in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while that if you look around for somebody or something to blame your problems on, you can always find somebody. There's always somebody out there you can blame. You know, it's a brother or a sister or a mother or a father or a spouse or your dog or something or somebody that you can affix the blame to. Now that you've done that, what do we do next? What's next? Am I free? No. Am I relieved of the disease of alcoholism? No. Has anything changed? No. Things are still the way they were. Well, it didn't work. I found out it's not my fault and nothing happened. See, the thing is that all of us have grown up. I mean, there's no such thing as a family that's not dysfunctional. It's just the way life is. You know, you can always find something wrong. So I went through all these things and found, and I didn't even run out of stuff. You know, there's still a lot more things I could tell you that make it even further convincing that none of this was my fault. But the point is, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous as a victim. You know, and victims are powerless over many things. I have learned since I've been here that my troubles were my own making. You know, and I can't even tell you how pleased I am to know that deep inside where I live. I am so pleased to know that. I'm no longer a victim. Because if my troubles are of your making, I'm screwed. Before I can get any better, I got to get you to change. If my problems are your fault, before my life can improve, you have to change. And I'm glad that's not the way it is. So, I mean, there were a lot of other things that went on that caused me a lot of trauma too. I was married several times along the way, and I remember my first wife, when we were going together, she told me one night she was worried about me driving home and that I needed to take this little pill that she had and it would keep me awake going home. And so I took that little pill and, boy, she was right. I didn't get sleepy all the way home or all the rest of that night or all the next day. And I'm on the phone wanting to know what that was. And that was dextroamphetamine sulfate. She was a nurse. And I said, where did you get it? She says, well, you got a closet full of it here at work. And I said, where does it come from? She says, well, the drug guys bring it by and they just leave samples. I said, well, what do you do with it? She says, well, when the closet gets full, we throw it away. Let it fill up again. I said, throw it away? Don't throw it away. You know, bring it home. So she did bring that, and pretty soon I'm using it faster than the drug salesmen are leaving the samples. And, you know, it's funny about me and those drugs. The only drug I ever cared to take was dextroamphetamine sulfate. And the only reason I like to take that is because with that drug, you can just drink enormous quantities of alcohol. I mean, you can party for the whole weekend and never look back. And you can get up in the morning and make it to work no matter what you did the night before or how long you did it. And you can look alert. And so that was my big deal. And she just said, well, no problem. You know, I'll just order some. And I said, how do you do that? She said, I just write a letter to Smith, Kline, and French and tell them, send us a couple of bottles, how much you want. And so I'm buying this stuff in bottles of 1,000, these big bottles like you see at the pharmacy, and anytime I want it, and I'm supplying all my friends. I had quite an entourage. By this time I'd moved to California and become incredibly hip, and I was living out at the end of Ventura Boulevard out in that area, and I had quite an entourage out in the west end of the valley out there, because I just passed this stuff out. It didn't mean anything to me. I mean, it's costing me $5.75 a bottle. I didn't care anything about selling it. I just gave it away. You know, and Fred's place, which is a very sophisticated place I used to drink after work, Fred's place was always full of the regulars waiting for me to get there after work. I'd pass out the speed and we'd just all tear the place down every night. And, you know, at the same time I was doing that, I was also looking really good professionally, because, see, as I said, that speed, you get up and get to work, man, you can make it. And somehow it doesn't seem right to call it speed. You know, I mean, speed is what some guy out in Riverside makes in his garage, you know. This was stuff made by an ethical pharmaceutical company. But I was doing very well professionally, because I could go forever. I never got tired. And I wandered off into the computer field and was just looking really good. And you know, by the time I was 34 years old, I was vice president of a computer company. By the time I was 35 years old, it was bankruptcy time for that company. By the time I was 38 years old, I was working for a little second-rate outfit in Kentucky, and by the time I was 40 years old, I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I was 34, which is the part I like to remember, I was a vice president. There was an old comedian named Fred Allen. He was so funny. He had such a great dry sense of humor. And I'm really not old enough to remember him, but I remember my parents listening to him on the radio at night before TV, and Fred Allen described the vice president as a fungus that attaches itself to a desk. I like to remember that. But on the one hand, I'm looking really good. I'm soaring professionally. I'm on airplanes all the time, and I'm flying around, and I'm in New York City presenting a technical paper, and I'm down in Atlanta chairing a meeting at a conference and doing all this stuff, just looking great. And that's all I cared about. I didn't care about what was really going on. I really wasn't trying to do any good work. I was trying to appear that I was doing, I was trying to make it appear that I was doing good work. I wasn't trying to really be anything. I was just trying to make it appear that I was something. That's all I ever wanted. Screw how I feel. How do I look? Do I look good? I mean, if I look good, that's all I cared. plumbing the shallows of my personality. And I had a wife that at that time was beginning to get over the edge, as we say today. She came at me one time and she said, you know, Dave, You don't ever give anything. You know, you just take. You don't ever give anything. And I got really mad. I was just furious with her. And I said, what on earth are you talking? What are you talking about? You know, you need to go in there and look in your closet. You need to go out and look in the driveway at what you drive to and from work. You need to go in there and look out in the backyard and look at that guy cutting your grass and cleaning your swimming pool. So I didn't get it. Wasn't even close. She wasn't talking about all that crap. She was talking about me giving something of myself to my family, to my children, and to her. And it just went right over my head. You know, it's like the guys that built the railroad tracks. Didn't work. And so what I'm describing to you is just the typical life of a guy that has the disease of alcoholism who is just slowly sinking into the quicksand and doesn't even know it. And I'm telling you that all the people around me could see it. I mean, most of them didn't have a name for it, but they could see what was going on. They could watch me destroying myself. Everybody that cared anything at all about me took their very best shot at me. They all tried to do everything they could think of to help me. None of them knew what to do. And by the time I was 35, 36 years old, it was really coming unraveled fast. And I wound up at a little company in Kentucky, and I lasted 6 months. And I embarrassed and humiliated a friend of mine back there. He told everybody about this computer wizard that he knew in California, and he could get this guy to come back to Kentucky and help him get their computer operations off the ground. And I hadn't seen this guy in 4 or 5 years. And he had no idea what kind of shape I was in. And I showed up in Kentucky, and I humiliated him. I embarrassed him. I would go out for lunch. You know, they had some really unfortunate things going on in Kentucky. You know, they wanted you to be at work on time. You know, and on time was like 8 o'clock in the morning. And they wanted you to stay there until noon and be back by 1 and work till 5. And, you know, I couldn't do that kind of stuff. I mean, I had to shake so bad by 11 or 11:30. It wasn't a question of wanting a drink. I had to have a drink. And I would go out at noon, and I would overshoot, and I'd come back drunk, and I'd sit in my chair, you know, the big computer whiz from California, and I'd fall asleep. And all the people that he had told about me would come by and see me sitting in there. You know, and if your nose worked, you know where I went for lunch. And so I lasted about 6 months, and I got fired. And it broke his heart to fire me. You know, I mean, it really hurt him bad to have to fire me. But he did, and being a true alcoholic, I couldn't let him get away. I humiliated him, I embarrassed him, I guilt-tripped him into 2 or 3 weeks of severance pay. And while I was there in Kentucky, that wife sent me a letter, and she said, "You know, buddy, I wish I had the courage to come and tell you this to your face, but I don't. You know, but I'm not coming to Kentucky, and I'm never coming back. And you know, I'm just going to stay down here where I am. And good luck, but we're through." And so there I was. And the only place I wound up back in Texas. I mean, you know, there's no particular reason why. Somebody offered me a job in Dallas, and I took it. Some poor schmuck back there didn't. You know, I always did interview well though. But I wound up in Texas. That's where I ran out of rope, and I wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was sent to AA by the Dallas County Mental Health Clinic. I had a lady named Jeanette Beavers who sent me to AA and saved my life. She stayed there for a long time. I don't know how she took that job because she had to listen to my drivel. You know, I can't remember what I told Jeanette, but I had a standing appointment every Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and I showed up. And because Jeanette's the only person I had to talk to, you know, and she was sort of a captive audience. They have to sit there and listen. You know, it's their professional duty. But I don't know what I told her, but it was just drivel. You know, I went in there and told her how my life was. You know, what I shared with her about my life was that none of it's my fault. You know, I didn't do and look what they did to me. I don't know, for the life of me, I don't know how anybody could sit there and listen to that drivel, you know, just Monday after Monday, hour after hour. But she did, and finally I mentioned my drinking, and she immediately said, "Dave, you know, why don't you go to AA?" And so that's how I came to be here. She told me I needed to come here. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing here. I didn't know anything. And I do know, however, that some things happened in my first few months of sobriety in Town North in Dallas, Texas, that altered the course of my life. In fact, that's not really how I feel about it at all. I used to think that the course of my life had been altered. I used to think that my life had been restored, had been saved by Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have long since quit believing that. That's really not the way I feel about it. The way I feel about it today is that I have been given a brand new life by Alcoholics Anonymous that I would not have had a prayer of ever having had it not been for the program and for the people in it. Because I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know where to go. And I had no examples to go by. I read a lot of self-help books written by everybody across the spectrum. But, you know, they were very interesting and I enjoyed reading them, but they didn't do anything. I had no way. I had no tools. I had no knowledge of how to integrate what's in these books and keep them day after day after day. And Alcoholics Anonymous makes that possible. Made that possible for me. So I remember some of the early things that happened, and I remember them well, as a matter of fact. There's a fellow in this room who doesn't know. I don't think I've ever even mentioned this to him. We don't talk that much anyway, but because he lives in one area of town, I live in another, but we don't get to see each other very often. But I remember one night when I was just a few weeks sober, a guy named Phil Allnut said, "Hey, there's a guy coming to speak from California. He's going to speak at our birthday party." And I said, "Who is that?" He said, "It's a guy named Clancy." He said, "You know, you're really like Clancy." And I remember the time went by, and I remember sitting in a house one night, Nancy Hyde's house, had a brother named Bill Prothrow. And Bill helped me more than anything. He had about 30 years at the time, and I'll tell you about him in a minute. But I remember sitting there that night, and I remember very clearly Clancy talking about a guy they call Sleeves. And I remember that to this day. I remember the story, and I didn't know when I heard it was going to have such a beneficial impact on my life. But I've never forgotten it. And it was really meant something to me to hear that when I was just a few weeks sober, because it gave me a lot of hope. And this guy, Bill Prothrow, who's long since dead. You know, my group was breaking up. They were having a big argument over playing dominoes. I mean, and they're going to have a big meeting. And people are mad at each other because the non-players over here don't think it's right. And the players over here say, "Well, we don't play during meetings. What's wrong with it?" And I don't know what I'm going to do. These are people that I love. I've been in this group a few months now, and, you know, 3 or 4 months. And what am I going to do? Whose side am I going to be on? I have friends that I love on both sides. What am I going to do? And Bill says, "Well, don't worry about this." He said, "You know, they'll either play dominoes or they won't hear. And the losers will get mad and they'll go buy a coffee pot and go find a church basement somewhere and start another meeting. We'll have 2 meetings wherever you used to have one. You can go to both of them." That had never occurred to me. Never occurred to me that I could do that. But I remember an old man from Laguna who's also dead. And he came to town not long after that. He and his wife. And I was trying to be, trying to make conversation, just trying to get to know him, and I said, "You know, they told me you can walk on water. Is that right?" And he said, "It is." "Let me show you how." And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Go get that mop." And And I know how important going and getting that mop is today. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. And you gave me your time, and you gave me your honesty, and you would tell me the truth. You loved me enough to tell me the truth, even when I didn't want to hear it. And as a result of all that, I managed somehow at first to just quit drinking. You know, I managed to make it 24 hours without a drink. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And you know, that group was real big on working steps. Very big on working steps. And they made it real clear that they thought it was a good idea if I did too. And I had a sponsor who had worked them himself, and he thought I should. And so we set about to do the steps, and my life really then began to change. And, you know, our book says great events will come to pass for you and for me, but the thing is that the great events are my great events, and your great events are yours. And so the things that have really happened in my life that touch me deep within, you know, are very difficult to relate to you because they won't touch you the way they touch me. But I can tell you that I have never known anyone who has not fulfilled the conditions of this program who did not have great events come to pass in their life. After I've been sober for a while, I moved away from Dallas. I moved to Utah. And I moved back to Texas. And when I moved back to Texas, I met a lady, and her name was Polly. And Polly and I were friends for about three and a half years, I guess, before anything ever happened between us. We were just good AA friends. And one night, it just turned out that, you know, that I found out that I just really could not. I just really didn't want to go on living without Polly anymore. So Polly and I since we've gotten married, and we live together now. And I want to tell you a little bit about what happens to us when we fulfill the conditions of this program. And I'll tell you about a couple of my great events that have come to pass in my life as a result of this. First of all, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have the faintest idea how to carry on a relationship on any level with another human being. I could not be a boss. I could not be an employee. I had a couple other marriages that I didn't go into. Like my second wife, the honest truth is I cannot even remember which year we got married, much less which month, week, or day. And that's, you know, unfortunately that's true. But I remember that my first wife and my second wife and my third wife all had stepchildren. And our routine exchange between me and any one of those stepchildren, well, the last wife, the relationship with the stepchildren was a little better, but it certainly wasn't acceptable. But I can remember an exchange that was sort of a routine exchange. I remember one afternoon Bradley came home from school. Bradley was 12 years old at that time. And he came in, and I was standing there either making a drink or drinking a drink, because that was my life. And I said something, and Bradley said something, and Bradley then he says, "Did it ever occur to you that I hate your guts?" And the very best that I could come back with at my most shining hour was, "Did it ever occur to you that I don't give a shit?" That's as good as I could do. And my relationships with those women were the same, about on the same level. You know, that's as good as I could do. And I met Polly, and Polly and I got married. And by this time, the program has had a little time to work on me, and I have gone through the steps, and I have been doing pretty well, and things are going along, but they're not really great yet, but they're getting better. And Polly has a couple of boys, you know, stepchildren. And Polly and I lived in Michigan. The first 10 months we were married, we lived in Michigan. It was just wonderful. It was all moonlight and roses and soft music. And it was just great. And we decided, you know, we've had enough of Michigan. We're going back to California. Well, I had lived in California before. Polly had not. But we're going to California. We're going to Southern California. And the first thing that happened was her youngest son, James, says, "Oh, great, I've been wanting to go to UCLA. I want to go to college. I'll come live with you." Uh-oh. But see, if you know Polly is pure love. And as close to anybody that's pure love as I've ever seen. And so she thought that was a wonderful idea. And frankly, I didn't have that much trouble with it. It just scared me. You know, like, I don't do good here. Uh-oh. You know, some of my warts are going to start showing. So we went back to California. We lived, and here came James, and then James arrived. God, I wish I had time to tell you about James in the first year. Whoa! He had some friends that would just take your breath away. Whew. Hung out a lot at Venice Beach. Talked about nonconformism. He would come roaring down the stairs in these ragged cutoffs, and I'd say, "Oh, you're going? I see you have your Venice Beach uniform on. You're going to Venice Beach." And he said, "How'd you know?" And I said, "You got your uniform on." I said, "If you want to go be a real nonconformist, go down there in a coat and tie." But slowly, it took a long time. It didn't take a long time for James to get accustomed to me. You know, I mean, he accepted me very quickly. It took a long time for me to accept him. Because I have all those character defects that have not been resolved yet. I'm afraid, you know, of the power that he has to, you know, have an impact on my life. Just a lot of things. But that went on with James. And then the next thing you know, we got a boy, and he's back in Michigan by this time. And he's coming out for a visit or two, and things are moving along, and I am slowly getting a little better, and I'm getting a little more comfortable with James, and I'm glad to see him come along. And then James graduated from college, and we went to his graduation, and we went to see our other son in Michigan. I mean, first Michigan, and then New Jersey a few times. And slowly, inexorably, Alcoholics Anonymous continued to work in my life. Now, James came to live with us in 1981. A couple of years ago, Russ and I, the oldest son, were running in the park. We like to run sometimes on Saturday morning. Oh, he's got a bum knee now. We haven't been able to run in a while. But we'd run in the park, and we'd talk. And he told me one morning we were running, he said, "You know, you're the only person that I know that I can feel like I can really talk to, that I can really be open with and upfront with, and I can really talk to." And he said, "I want you to know I really appreciate that." And James, a couple of years ago, he and his wife Kelly, they're both members of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. He and his wife, Kelly, decided it was time to have a little grandson for me and Polly. And so they did that, and they had a little boy. And see, all the time Kelly is pregnant with this little boy, James and Kelly are talking about girl, 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 girl. You know, it's going to be a little girl. Kelly didn't want a little boy. She didn't like little boys. They're dirty. They make too much noise. And so we went through a lot of names for this little girl. What are we going to name this little girl? And it was decided that Caitlin, you know, we're going to name the little girl Caitlin. And so the 9 months grow by, and we're on the phone one day talking to Kelly in the labor room. I mean, it's 1995 after all. And so we're in Southern California. She's in Chicago in a hospital in the labor room. There's a lot of friends gathered around the room with her. I'm sure she was delighted to have everybody there. And we're on the phone talking to her. Hi, sweetheart. How's it going? And So finally the baby was born, and it wasn't a little girl. It was a little boy. And they called up, and they said, we wanted to tell you what we named our baby. We named him Ryan David. And that's a great event for me. That is a great event for me. I am so pleased with what you have done with me. I am so pleased with what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. I love those two boys and their two wives with all my heart. And that little grandson, when he comes to see me, he's a little two-year-old guy. You know, he's deaf. He was born deaf. And he's getting a lot better. The news is encouraging. But you know, our whole family is going to school to learn how to sign. You know, and we all, and he signs, you know, and it's dynamite to have your little grandson come up to you, and he says, you know, and he tells you, come on, we're going, and we go down to the swimming pool, and we walk up to the gate, and he says, open the gate, you know, and he says, milk, more milk. Just absolutely dynamite to have that little guy named after you. And he just loves me to death, and I just absolutely adore him. And see, I didn't even like little babies when I got here. You have given me my very life, the things that I enjoy, that I love most of all about my life, and I have a wonderful life. I don't know anybody that enjoys their life any more than I do. And every bit of it is a direct result of keeping faith with Alcoholics Anonymous. And just doing what you told me to do, what you asked me to do. Those are great events for me. I'm glad you asked me to your conference, and my wife is going to speak next, and you get the other side of the story. But it's great to be here with some old friends. And meet some new friends, and I want to tell you in parting that Ryan David sends his love, and God bless. Thank you.